book of Esther is an unusual or unique book in that the name of deity in any form does not occur in it at any place. And yet, the book is filled with God and His providence, care, and keeping His people. It's a great book on divine providence. I want to say just a little about the background of it. We're in Persia. The Jews have returned, rebuilt the temple, and the those that were left were threatened with extinction. Ahasuerus, who was the Xerxes of history, was king at that time. Now, in this number of lessons we want to give, first let me talk about Esther for a moment. Esther had a Hebrew name, Hadassah. Now, Hadassah meant myrtle. Esther, and we don't know why she was given the name Esther, but the word Esther probably means in the Persian star, or in the Babylonian Ishtar, which was a goddess of the Babylonians. Now, just how she happened to have this name star or Ishtar, whichever it might be, we don't know. But at any rate, she was a cousin of Mordecai. Mordecai was a descendant of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. Well, that would mean then that she was a Benjamite also. Some have tried to trace her lineage back to King Saul, therefore claiming she had royal blood, but we are unsuccessful in that. We will not try to argue any point from that point of view. But at any rate, she was an orphan. Her father, Abigail, had died, both had a father and a mother. And Mordecai, who was her cousin, took her into his home to rear her and loved her very, very much. Mordecai himself was a strong nationalist. He was strong for his people and for their return home and for their overcoming any Persian power. God favored him throughout this book here. Now, Xerxes ruled from 486 to 465, 21 years. From 486, that would be just before Ezra came and after Nehemiah had come. So it's interesting to me, and I don't know why, but interesting that neither Nehemiah nor Ezra make any mention of that calamity that faced the Jews of destruction. But none of them make any mention of that. And so we just don't know any more what the book of Esther says. But this book of Esther, I think, has two particular purposes for its having been written, and maybe three. I'll notice one of them a little later. But it gives us the origin of the Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M, Purim. Pur meant the casting of lots. So this was a feast kept as a result of their casting lots, or cast the lots to determine the day of the destruction of the Jews. Well, when God spared them and they were delivered, then they declared this feast. Mordecai did, was the instigator of this feast, the Feast of Purim, kept in memory of the casting of lots to bring about the destruction of the Jews. Alright? And so that was one purpose. I think another important purpose of the book is to reveal the providence of God. How that God, in His providence, took a little orphan girl, raised her up to the place of a consort of the great emperor, the great king of the Persian Empire, and used her as a means of delivering his people from destruction. And as we go along, we're going to notice that every event or incident in this is a link in the chain of providence about by which they were delivered. I think the two greatest lessons historical incidents on providence are Joseph and his his being elevated to the place of second to the Pharaoh of Egypt, and Esther, who was elevated from a little orphan. He was in prison, and down there sold as a prisoner, slave, then to Egypt, Joseph's wife, elevated. And she was elevated by the providence of God from an orphan to the queen of this empire, great empire. So both of these, when you go through and look at each individual, and I preached on both of them, I think, had time gone by, I sure have, why, each of these is a very strong lesson on God's providence and how it works. Not necessarily miraculously, but through the development of events ordinary in the lives of these individuals. So we'll notice that as we go along. Now, a third one I'll call attention to in just a moment that is not necessarily mentioned here, but may have been. But at any rate, then you have then Ahasuerus, we've mentioned him here. He was the son of Darash, the great, and ruled, as I said, for 21 years here. And he was murdered in his bed by anarchists at that when he ceased to rule over there. So this seems to be now another character we talked about would be Vashti. Vashti, the word means beautiful woman, a beautiful woman. And Vashti was the queen, wife of Ahasuerus, and we'll study that in just a few moments. Now, one of the things I want to note in our lesson this morning, as we read this chapter especially, I want us to note this Xerxes, the extent of his empire, the great power, the glory of it, and his power and how he exerted that power. And then I want to notice a parallel between that, and I think the book might be teaching that, parallel between his work and his power and God and how he works. There's a parallel we want to draw after in just a few moments. So if you'll turn to your book now, I have some questions in secular history about this. There are two historians that teach, or rather that reveal, that the wife really of him, of this man, was a mistress, A-M-E-S-T-R-I-S, a mistress, a mistress, or something of that nature. But at any rate, the historians say that she was banished for a while and worked her way back into the favor of Ahasuerus, and he did take her back. And so some think that possibly Vashti was this woman, but there's no historical evidence that she was ever called Vashti or Vashti was called by her name. So you've got a problem now in secular history. I'm not particularly concerned with. We're concerned what the Bible says and what the Bible teaches, and believe that this is accurate, of course, because it's God's word, but we're not sure how it fits into the history of that period. So we have a problem that we're not going to try to deal with other than just merely mention it to you. But this mistress here, she later on, after he took her back into his favor, right, she knew he was having an affair with a woman and her brother, and so she mutilated the mother, and then he did banish her for good then. At any rate, we got to leave that as history and not Bible. That's not mentioned in the Bible. So we turn to our lesson. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus who reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. All right, now as we look at this fellow, and remember he's the Xerxes of history. Right, as we look at this fellow here, as king now, he's a king exerting great power. And we want to look at how he exercised that power. Great power. Exercise of it. Now first of all, as a king, here's his kingdom and the extent of it. His kingdom extended all the way from India to the east, down to the west to Ethiopia in Egypt. It was exceedingly great empire, great kingdom there. And he moves on now, and that in those days the throne of the kingdom, which was at Shushan, the palace, that is Susa, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his, that would be 483, he made this feast unto all his princes, and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces, being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom. All right. Now here then is the extent of it. The first of all, his kingdom and the extent of it, as we suggested there. And now second, there is the glory of that kingdom, and he showed them all the glory of his kingdom. Now the book of Esther does not tell us why he had this 6 months feast, as it's called here, or meeting with all of his nobles. It for them to make his plans to invade Greece. Now his father Darius the Great, he had invaded Greece in an effort to Greece that was defeated at the battle, I believe the battle of Marathon or Thermopylae, one of the other, in 1890. Well, now then, this would be down in 490. Now we're down to 483. Now he was defeated at Salamis, Battle of Salamis, in 3 years later in 480. Historians tell us that this meeting was a plan which does not interest Esther here. This book interests us so far as the book is concerned. But anyway, he met in order to formulate his plans to invade Greece and destroy it. So here now he's showing them the glory of his kingdom, and they spent 6 months there. And this is called a feast. Now in the third year, that would be in 483, he made a feast unto all his princes here, and showed them the riches of his glorious kingdom, and the honor of his excellent majesty, many days. Even 144 days, that would be 180, that would be 6 months there. That's the glory and splendor of it. And when those days were fulfilled, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan in the palace, both great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now described the splendor of his court here, the splendor of his palace here, and that a very splendid thing, the splendor now of his palace, the place of ruling. You should know there's a feast of 7 days. Now, interpreting this in a lot of secular history, that would mean that these 6 months in which he entertained these nobles and all that were devoted to plans to invade Greece. Now, when that concluded, now he had a 7-day feast there for these all the individuals in the city there. That would explain the two there, which the book itself does not deal with because it's not interested in that aspect of it. That's not of any interest to us. Now, notice further now, and in the glory of his palace, look at it. There were hangings of white cloth, of green, now that's probably cotton, and of blue, because white and blue were the favorite colors of Persians, and purple along with it. The cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The couches were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and white, that's probably covered with a silver and gold threaded cloth. It may be that the furniture was inlaid with silver or gold. It wouldn't be solid gold furniture, but it would be gold in the trimmings or in the decorations of it. Red and white and yellow and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold and vessels being diverse one from another, no two of them alike, and royal wine in abundance, according to law. Right, now I want to note another thing here. There's not only the splendor, but here is the abundance. Now, everything that goes with his court, drinking and all of that. There's a great kingdom, great extent of it, the glory of it, the splendor of his palace, here the capital, and here the abundance of everything necessary for it. Wine to the bounty of the king, according to the bounty of the king, and the drinking was according to the law. None could compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. You didn't have to drink, or maybe that permitted them to drink all they wanted, or whatever it was. At any rate, they could or could not. But there was an abundance now of the provisions for this great period. Also, Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house, which belonged to King Ahasuerus, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. He commanded, now know it is his power to command. He commanded these three men here, the seven chamberlains that ministered in the presence of Ahasuerus, the king, to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king with a crown royal, to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look upon. Right, so here then is power to command, and expect that command to be carried out. So he commanded these individuals, Vashti, to come in. Now, I'm a great admirer of Vashti. She knew that these individuals were about a half drunken stupor there, and that she was not going to come in and parade herself before those individuals. So she refused to do what the king said, but nevertheless, the king had the power to command it, and it was a terrible thing to violate the command of the king. Moving on over now, the king commanded to bring in Vashti, but the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by the chamberlain. Therefore, was the king very wroth, and his anger burned within him. All right, now here then, he's capable also of anger at the when his command is not carried out. There's the anger and the wrath of the king because his command was disobeyed, because it was rejected, repudiated. Right? They're looking at the different positions of this individual now. How the anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men, who knew the times, for he was the king's, so was the king's manner, toward all the new law and judgment. And the next under him were these seven men, him and Mimikin was the last one, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. These are his counselors, and there's to him. Right, now they're going to give him some advice as to what to do now, counsel him in this matter. Right, what shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to law? Because she has not done the bidding of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains. And Mimikin answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king of Ahasuerus. So now then, what she has done has not only affected the king, but affected the whole province. The whole empire, because those that hear of it will take that as a bid to rebel against authority also, don't you see, especially in the home. Now, that's their reasoning, what we're looking at here. For this deed of the queen will come abroad unto all women to make their husbands contemptible in their eyes when it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. And this day were the princesses of Persia and Media, who have heard of the deed of the queen, say the like unto the king's princes. So I think they're kind of thinking of themselves also, what their wives may do there. But at any rate, on the point we're making, we're not justifying the king in what he does. We're simply considering his power, the power to command and to execute a judgment against the violation of his command. So will there arise much contempt and wrath. If it please the king, let there go forth a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes. Let me hear the command now. It's going to be written here. Let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, the Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus. Right? Now here we have then, here's his anger, now then, that a command be made, and it be written. So here's a command now that is going to be written. I'm going to write this command, and here, after what happened to her, that will be written. And furthermore, that is unalterable. A command from a Medo-Persian emperor was unalterable, could not be altered, unalterable. All right? It stands. Can be changed. You remember that in the book of Daniel when we studied. Once that command had been made, now to put Daniel in the lion's den, the emperor couldn't take it back. So put him in there, but the king, felt that God would deliver him. You remember that beautiful story we had a few months ago. Right? Now, I know it a little further now. Lest I come no more before Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published, and it is not only written, but I published, throughout all his kingdom, for it is great, all the wives will give to their husbands honor, both the great and small. And the saying pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan, for he sent letters to all the king's provinces, and to every province, and to every people, after their language. Right? And another thing to notice here these letters, the letters now, were sent, a letter sent unto all, and you notice it's in a language that they understood. It's in their own language. Now look at this part here, the language there that they could understand. And now notice here what it says. Every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house and should speak according to the language of his people. Now, that's a little uncertain as to what that means, but it seems to me what he's saying is that this letter unto these men is in their own language, and now they're able to speak in their own language in the household that they might be understood. Right? Now, let's look at that for just a moment, because this, I think, is one of the important points of this book, is to show here this matter here of the king, the power, and the authority there. Right? The extent of his kingdom, here the glory of it, the splendor of his palace, here the abundance of everything that goes in, here the power to command, here when violated, here's his anger and wrath, here the commandment now that he sends out is written, is unalterable, is sent in letters sent to the various provinces and in a language that they can understand. Now, here's a thought that had never occurred to me until last night. I was talking to a friend of mine, called me from Houston, and just incidentally we were talking, visiting over the phone. He visited a lectureship where one of the men presented the idea of the parallel between Artaxerxes and God. Right? Which I never thought of, and I want you to think about it for a moment. Now let's look at that. And now when we think about God, God's kingdom extends from sea to sea and the river to the end of the earth. Right? That here's the end too. Here is the glory of God's kingdom. It's a glorious kingdom. Here is the splendor of his throne, as described in Revelation of the faces, the splendor of his throne here. Here is the abundance with which God provides everything that we have when he invites us to a feast or to come and serve him. Everything necessary is provided. Right? So here in abundance. He has the power to command. So when God commands and that command is not recognized, then what's the result of it? Here's God's anger and wrath demonstrated in an execution of a judgment. Right? Now then, when God gives commandments, he had written those commandments. He wrote the law by Moses and wrote by the prophets there. That's been preserved. Here, God's law is unalterable. No man can change that which God has written. God speaks, that's the final word. Right? And here also then, the letters, the books of the Old Testament, the books of the New, they've been written and preserved, but they're written in language that we can understand. We all understand it. Right? Now, here's another point you might think of in that. Now then, as we look at this parallel with God in him, here then was God's first wife, that was the Jews. God had a right to put her away. When Israel disobeyed the commands and the laws of God, then God had a right to put her away, and did according to Jeremiah 3 and Isaiah chapter 50. God put her away. Right now then, he had the right to take a new wife, and that's what God has done in this, in the new covenant.
Well, here God puts away a wife. Everyone put away, and there's a new wife, and he takes a spiritual wife.
So you see, and I've never seen that. Hey, this boy does mention a few things. I went back and got my Bible. I spent all day studying on Esther. I went back and got my Bible and went through here and looked at all these things. Oh, I said, man, well, I've seen that before. With a parallel. Now, maybe that explains why the word God is never mentioned in the book, in deity in any form. That an individual who reads that, the Jew who reads that with understanding, can see here the parallel, and now then what will God's going to put Israel away? Why? Because she rebelled against God. Now, that doesn't justify the king and what he did. I'm not doing that. I'm not arguing the right or wrong of what Artaxerxes did. All I'm presenting is what is said and the parallel between what is said and God and what he has done. It's a picture I've never gotten before. Did you ever talk about that with me? Anybody ever thought about it?
They're not themselves
to drink. How's that? No, you're not. I confess, you partake of God's blessings, and you partake of the blessings and not partake of. But when God gives a command, it's as unalterable as that of the Medes and the Persian veterans. So that gave me a completely new insight. I think Brother Almond Williams, down at their father's college there, actually, he was out here with us, visited us a couple of years ago. You remember, I don't know what we did, we came to church with us or not. He was visiting us, an excellent Bible student. He is a meticulous student and a very deep thinker. He comes up with a lot of things others haven't seen yet. Well, I went back and read the first chapter with a new, completely new point of view there. And maybe that gives an understanding as to why the word God doesn't occur there. Is let them see the parallel there and react. Now then, of course, he goes on from there now in selecting this girl there. He goes on selecting her and showing her there his right to, if he had a right to put away a wife, he disobeyed it, and a right to take another wife, he would. Well, so did God. God did also. So the man today, if she be unfaithful to him, put her away, he has a right free to marry another one. So the woman also. But the point is here, if the exercise of power here, and now when you violate God's law here, well, here's the consequence. But further, here's the point I want to make clear. Here the idea further is now, as God proceeds to save his people, here in his providence, he can do that. Right? Now, if God has all of that power, and you see the king exercising his power to go through, but at any rate, as he exercises that power, you see the providence of God and his ability to save his people from that condition. Just as old Ahasuerus saved the Jews, gave them the right to fight back, and thus preserve himself. Now that law that he signed, when he signed the law there, giving old Haman, didn't think of the name anymore, giving Haman the right to slay the Jews, he couldn't retract that. But now what did he do? He gave another law that permitted them to defend themselves. Alright, now when God gives a law and I violate that law, God's not going to excuse me in violating that law. He's not going to change the law to suit me. What did he do? He gave another law by which I can be justified and forgiven of the transgression I've committed, don't you see? And I really think that this little book of Esther has a whole lot of lessons in it that I hadn't seen before that this is going to open the door to. And I hope it will for you. You have a question on this? Make myself clear. I'm going to leave it right there anyway. Well, we'll go ahead. All right. Now then, after these things, now I know this is the third year, now I all know some dates as we go along. Now this took place here in the third year, which would be 483. Right, now moving on, after these things, when the wrath of God was pacified, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under custody of Haggai, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them, and let the maiden that pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Well, God provides everything necessary for our purification to become the bride of Christ. Well, that's indicated in the New Testament over and over again. God cleanses, purifies us. He made that provision in the blood of the Lamb. But so all I'm saying is, this is not a prophecy. I'm just showing some parallels while I'm doing it. You're looking at parallels here. This is not a prophecy of something to come, of the Christ or anything else. It's showing the parallel between the events back there and parallel in God's exercise of power under the new and today. Well, we'll move on from that. Yeah, I want to ask a question. I know I'm reading this rather hurriedly, but I want to get down to a certain point if I can here in this. All right? Verse 5. There was a certain Jew in Shushan, the palace, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jai, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. As far as I said a while ago, both of them were Benjamin, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives that had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, I don't think that means that he was carried away himself, but his forebears were carried away, and he was born there. But if he had been carried away, that would make him something like 110 to 125 years old at this time. That would be a little old to be appointed here to do all the things he does here. So I think what it means is just telling of his ancestors, and through his ancestors, he had been born, brought down here where he was born. That'll be in keeping with the Hebrew way of saying things and doing things. Well, I'll move on now. He'd been told, and he brought up Hadassah, that's Esther, that is Esther, that is uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maiden was fair and beautiful. And when her father and mother were dead, Mordecai took her for his own daughter. So she had become his adopted daughter here, for she was his cousin. Evidently, of course, she was a good deal younger than he was, but I don't think that he could have been 120 or 25 years old and been appointed the place he was appointed here in this. But we're not sure of that. Nobody knows. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when men and maidens were gathered together under Shushan the palace, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken into the king's house for the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women, and the maiden pleased him, and she obtained time somehow. I think that was a providential move there. And he speedily gave her the things for purification, for her portions, and the seven maidens who were meet to be given. Each one of these maids was provided with seven attendants to look after and to care for them. And all the things necessary for the purification were provided. Now, Esther had not made known her people, nor her kindred, but Mordecai had charged her that she should not make it known. Mordecai walked every day before there to find out how she was getting along. Very interested in his cousin, who was his daughter by adoption. Now, when the turn of every maiden was come to go into the king Ahasuerus, after that it had been done to her according to the law of the woman, 12 months, for so were the days of their purification, according to which 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with sweet odors, these other things there. Alright, and so this keeper of the girls took an interest in her and provided her especially with everything that she needed. Down to verse 15. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abigail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but that Haggai, the king's chamberlain, appointed. She left it up to him, since he had done such a good job of caring for her. So, verse 16, so Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus under his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tibeth, in the 7th year of his reign. All right. Now, that's from 3 to the 7th. There's 4 years in there. So, 4 years from the time that this started until now. Now, why so long? Well, during that time, that Ahasuerus, Xerxes, was preparing his army and invading invading Greece, and were defeated there in 480. So then that would be a year after he got back. So that accounts for that. So we can put the things together and determine that it was when he returned from the campaign defeated that he seemed to remember Vashti, and that's when they really selected these girls out of one become queen. Right? And now I want to move on down now to one or two other points here. Yes. Why don't I just read the rest of this? And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, nobody knows exactly what that signifies, and Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. In those days while Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, he had a very important point. Now I want you to notice this in the chain of development here that brings Esther to the top place of saving the nation. Notice this carefully. The king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, a big fan and Teresh, of those that kept the threshold, were wroth and sought to lay hands on the king of Ahasuerus. And they were going to put him to death. They were going to murder him, assassinate him. And the thing became known to Mordecai, who showed it unto Esther, the queen, and Esther told the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, and it was found to be so, they both were hanged on a tree. Now notice this little point. And were written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. Right? Now here's a very important event God's rule, oversight, the providence. Here then, in the chain of providence. Here, if these two men plotted to assassinate the king, Mordecai learned it. He told Esther about it. Esther told the king, but told him in the name of Mordecai. So this was recorded now in the Chronicles of the king, so that sometime later, when the king couldn't sleep, he had him bring in the Chronicles of the king and read them, because the Chronicles he thought would be so dry that he would put him to sleep. I used to tell my wife, honey, what you need to do when you can't sleep, and I take one of my sermons and put it on there. But she sleeps pretty good sometimes in them, and it'll put you to sleep. I'm getting where I need that myself. I'm waking up at 2:30 every other morning. They can't go back to sleep at all. I waked up at 2:30 this morning, couldn't go back to sleep, saved my life, got it and went to work then. 3:00, 2:30, something like that. So I'm going to have to start playing my own records, I guess. Be one good way to do it. But anyway, when they got to this point in reading it, the king said, wait a minute, what's that? Had him restate it. And so why, he said, that man has to be honored. So that's a very important link in this chain, how it develops this matter. All right, well, I'm going to stop there. But I want you to go back now and restate this chapter and what we've said here. Now, I'm not looking here for a prophecy, but looking for a parallel. And I can't help but wonder if that hasn't been missed by all of us, which was one of the main purposes of the book, was to show here that as they've been under this king with all of this power, glory, and all that, there is God who kingdom and power and glory and commandments and written and language, you understand all that, transcends even what he did. And if they'd have seen that, well, they'd have gotten a lesson, I think, that the book wants to teach. Any question? Well, all right. We're going to leave it there instead of trying to get in the morning. So we're glad that Bobby and George are back with us again. And we hope that Doyle will get recovered. We trust that you'll pray for Doyle. Pray honestly, they may be spared to a fifth. We need him, of course he wants to live. We really need him to help us out when he is here. All right. Class is excused.